This recording is a production of Faith Builders Educational Programs. This presentation was recorded at Teachers Week 2021, held at Faith Builders from August 2 through 6.
Well, good morning and welcome. If I ran my business the way you people operate your school, I wouldn't be in business very long. I stood before an auditorium filled with outraged teachers who were becoming angrier by the minute. My speech had entirely consumed their precious 90 minutes of in-service training. Their initial icy glares had turned to restless agitation. You could cut the hostility with a knife. I represented a group of business people dedicated to improving public schools. I was an executive at an ice cream company that became famous in the middle 1980s when People magazine chose its blueberry flavor as the best ice cream in America. I was convinced of two things. First, public schools needed to change. They were archaic, selecting and sorting mechanisms designed for the industrial age and out of step with the needs of our emerging knowledge society. Second, educators were a major part of the problem. They resisted change, hunkered down in their feathered nest, protected by tenure and shielded by a bureaucratic monopoly. They needed to look to business. We knew how to produce quality, zero defects, total quality management, continuous improvement. In retrospect, the speech was perfectly balanced, equal parts of ignorance and arrogance. As soon as I finished, a woman's hand shot up. She appeared polite, pleasant. She was, in fact, a razor-edged veteran high school teacher who had been waiting to unload. She began quietly, "We are told, sir, that you manage a company that makes good ice cream?" I smugly replied, "The best ice cream in America, ma'am." "How nice. Is it rich and smooth?" 16% butterfat, I crowed. "Premium ingredients?" "Super premium, nothing but triple A." I was on a roll. I never saw the next line coming. "Mr. Bollamer," she said, leaning forward with a wicked eyebrow raised to the sky, "when you are standing on your receiving dock and you see an inferior shipment of blueberries arrive, what do you do?" In the silence of the room, I could hear the trap snap. I was dead meat, but I wasn't going to lie. "I send them back." "That's right. We can never send back our blueberries. We take them big, small, rich, poor, gifted, exceptional, abused, frightened, confident, homeless, rude, and brilliant. We take them with attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, junior rheumatoid arthritis, and English as their second language. We take them all, everyone. And that, Mr. Vollmer, is why it's not a business. It's school." In an explosion, all 290 teachers, principals, bus drivers, aides, custodians, and secretaries jumped up to their feet and yelled, "Yeah, blueberries, blueberries." So from your notes, or your outline, 1 Peter calls us to feed the flock of God, which is among you, taking the oversight thereof, not by constraint, but willingly, not for filthy lucre, but of a ready mind. Neither as being lords over God's heritage, but being in samples to the flock. Three words I'd like to lift out of here briefly. Oversight does bespeak, at least to some degree, of authority. So authority and serving are not two different concepts. They're not opposed to each other. Also, we're called to do this willingly, even if you were hired in the last days or weeks. I hope you're still willing, maybe somewhat obliged, maybe feel somewhat trapped, but I would encourage you to not go into the school year feeling victimized. I had to do this because it will affect how you look at serving your students, and it certainly will affect how you use your authority. In samples, teachers, I hope you're humbled, deeply humbled by the trust that the parents are putting in you by hiring you. If you think that the school is lucky that you are teaching school, now maybe they are lucky, but don't think that. Instead, you should feel deeply unworthy to teach other people's children. I have 7 children. If I do something wrong, if I talk in a way I shouldn't, if I am a poor example, that is terrible. But if I am a poor example to somebody else's children, that adds a layer of terribleness. Be humbled with the fact that parents who love their children and they care deeply about what's happening in the life of their child are saying, I release them to you. And I even give you authority over my child. Please take care of my child. Please just love my child. Please nurture and discipline and teach. Please don't undo what we're doing in the home. I think the longer I have taught and having children in school, the more that has weighed on me. The seriousness of being a teacher. We are influencing other people's children. It should make us very humble as teachers. It really should. And unworthy. And in understanding how much we need God's wisdom and grace and love and compassion. Because we're being trusted with other people's children. Matthew 20. Jesus here helps us understand authority and servanthood. And puts them together so beautifully. And Jesus called unto them and said, he's going to set this straight. Ye know that the princes of the Gentiles exercise dominion over them, and they that are great exercise authority upon them. But it shall not be so among you. But whosoever will be great, let him be your minister. And whosoever will be chief among you, let him be your servant. Even as the Son of Man, he, as an example, came not to be ministered unto, but to minister, and to give his life a ransom for many. Should you aspire to greatness according to this verse? I see heads going both ways. Should you aspire to greatness? What strikes us offhand is, of course not. That would be rather arrogant. I want to be a great person. But in the kingdom of God, and as God defines greatness, yes. Yes, because greatness is the first shall be last, the last shall be first. It's the concept that as I serve quietly and humbly, in God's eyes, I am great. In man's eyes, not necessarily. So we should aspire to greatness in the kingdom of God in terms of usefulness and contribution to the kingdom of God. And in God's eyes, he looks at us as a valuable servant. So authority. What is authority? Well, we really can't twist what authority is when we look at it from a biblical model. We don't reduce the power of authority, but we define how we use it. And we exercise in a context, but we don't strip away authority because authority, you know, looks like I'm trying to be great. Oh, it's just the opposite. Authority is the tool in which we can serve. And so it can be a little difficult to think through this, that authority seems to speak of power, greatness, self-serving. Well, that's what Jesus tried to help us understand. That's the Gentile mentality of authority. And we struggle with that sometimes, don't we? How dare you say that? You better respect me. I am the teacher, after all. We tend to use authority for self-serving purposes. That is the Gentile way. It is a propensity for all of us to think of authority as sort of to our advantage. And we sort of like it. It kind of feels good. And let's be honest, we struggle with that. But what do we do with that challenge, that carnal way of thinking of authority? So what's a Gentile concept? What's the way to greatness? The more authority, the greater I will be. And if I exercise authority, and the more people I have under me, it's just the way to greatness. Well, we see this all around us, don't we? And I am sure there are politicians, and there's great people of authority that have an humble heart. I'm not judging them. That would not be my job to do. But it would seem that outside of a changed heart, authority does corrupt people. Power corrupts, we say. Outside of a changed heart, authority at the end of the day has at least a self-serving component, at least. And we understand, we struggle with that. We want to be great, but let's think about what does it mean to be great in the kingdom. So the biblical concept is that authority gives us an opportunity to serve. Now, can you serve without authority? Can you serve without authority? You're not sure what you're supposed to say, yes or no. It depends, sort of, right? Sure, if you go to another country under an organization and you're helping to rebuild houses, you don't have much authority. You're just told what to do, and you're serving them. Beautiful. You can serve without authority in those ways. We serve each other. We don't say, well, I need some authority or I can't even help you. No, we bless other people. But in the classroom, can you serve without authority? No. So we're looking at the reason we need to bring authority in is because you need authority to serve in the classroom. Without authority, you surely will not serve your students. And so, again, think of authority as a tool. It enables you to serve in the context of the classroom. Other times we can serve without authority because we're not in that position. We're not controlling people. We're not calling the shots. We're not establishing culture. But when you need to do those things, authority is your tool. It is impossible. So again, let's not create this dichotomy that either I'm, you know, this authority person or else I'm a servant. And I just, you know, I'm this servant. No, we need to bring them together as a teacher. All right, let's look at some more details in relation to who you are as a teacher. And this maybe feels slightly off the subject, but I care about this a lot. Understanding your strengths and weaknesses. Number one, be yourself. Be yourself. Maybe you come to Teacher's Week and you see a teacher you really admire. It's like, I want to be like her. I want to be like him. Okay, we can aspire to be like other people in some ways, in that we are using some of the tools, some of the techniques they used. But at the end of the day, folks, we must embrace who God has made us to be and work in that framework. It just doesn't go so well to get far out of that, does it? Did you ever try to really be somebody else for a while? And doesn't go that well? It's just not you. Especially if it's almost a personality transformation. You know, just step outside of who you are and just going to almost be a different person. Try to act like somebody else. You have to be comfortable in your own skin, like we say, right? Why? Because that's who God created you to be. So what a variety that God uses in our classrooms. This is beautiful. I had the privilege of teaching for quite a few years with a large faculty. There's usually 10 to 12 of us, 13. Wow. We were very, very different one from another. That can undo our relationships, or it can be beautiful. And what makes a strong school as we accept each other's personality. But back to our own. There is indeed a range that you do need to stay in. I mean, please don't say, well, you know what? I am just such an undisciplined person, and that's just who I am. That's who I'm taking to the classroom. Or I am an extremely organized, austere person, and that's who I am. And that's what I'm going to be as a teacher. We do need to recognize that there's some edges to this, and we all have them. We all have some things we need to bring inside an acceptable, effective range. And so the person who is highly unorganized, which a lot of teachers really are, you know that? A lot. That's because teaching often kind of draws a flamboyant type of person, the sanguine, the one who just love relationships, and, you know, sort of goes with that territory. But there are teachers that are very organized, and then they maybe tend to be a little more on the other end. So we can put people sort of in categories, and this feels slightly cruel, but I think you can probably identify with a few types of teachers, I would suggest. We have, of course, as I said, maybe the most common, the relational. So their number one question is, how can I build relationships with my students? So, are you going to teach school? Yeah. So what are you excited about? Well, I just hope my students like me. Insecure, we don't want any conflict. We just want to love them, and we want them to love us. Yeah, we do, but should you go chasing that down? And we have teachers that maybe are more academic, and I've worked with a number of academic teachers through the years. Great teachers. They study well. They have a depth of knowledge that is intimidating to the rest of us. And they just study. They have a broad understanding of their subjects. They teach very well. They're organized. They maybe struggle relationally. Actually, a teacher asked me recently, have been a teacher, still involved in education. He said, some people say that highly intelligent teachers, and maybe highly educated, have problems getting along with their students. Is that true? I didn't know what to say, because he was one of them. And knowing him fairly well, I'm sure he's a great teacher. Nothing against him at all. I'm just saying, he asked a question because it was a question. Because he sensed that there could be some challenges. And in all honesty, there are some challenges that go with those very talented people. But they make excellent teachers as they acknowledge some of those challenges and work hard at building relationships with their students. And they watch other teachers and say, how do they seem to get along so well with their teacher? That can't change your personality. Please don't try. But think of ways that you can be accessible to your students and express interest in your students so you can build relationships. Not changing your personality, but you are understanding that with your gifts are some challenges. Just like with the more popular teachers, possibly, with their gifts, they have challenges too. So accepting who you are as a person and trying to bring in the edges, if you understand what I mean by that, that the things that actually are hurting you. There's teachers that maybe are a little more about style. I don't think there's quite as many of that, possibly, but they just love the decor. They love the charts. They love laying it out in an attractive, beautiful way. Great teachers as well. So be honest with your strengths, with your weaknesses. Observe other teachers, what works, and try to understand what ways that you can improve. But again, you need to accept who you are. That's just such an important thing. So let's look at your motives a little bit and how you use your authority. I think the longer you teach, the worse these motives can become in some ways. Does that make any sense to long-term teachers? The longer you teach, the more your motives and how you use your authority can become even increasingly selfish, or at least look that way. One motive I mentioned already, I want to be liked. So I'm going to use my authority to do all kinds of things so my students like me. Like things like, you know what? Once a week, we're going to have fun day. So we're going to pop balloons. We're going to, you know, have whatever class then is next. We're going to pull things out, you know, extra recess for a half an hour and do all these things that make school exciting. And really, I'm using my authority because at the end of the day, it looks like I'm serving my students, but I hope they go home and say, well, how much fun we had. And at church, I really have big ears as to what people are saying about school. Listen, we got to be honest. We love to be liked. And guess what? If you're not liked, you ought to figure out what's going on too. But when that is the pursuit of continually just wanting to be liked, wanting people to think well of you, you'll fall into some very bad traps. You really will. And at the end of the day, it's going to be disappointing. By maybe Christmas, you're going to run out of ideas, and your students really don't respond quite as well as you hoped. Just want to really caution, especially the new teachers. I understand. I have taught for many years, and I still am sensitive to what my students say about me. I still want to be liked. But again, if we use our authority to chase that purposefully, is that the servant heart? Or is it at the end of the day, really selfish? It's really about me looking good. I want to walk around in the community and be sort of, you know, the teacher that everybody likes. Again, if you're falling out of grace with your students and your parents, there's important questions to ask. There's a difference between pursuing the I want to be liked versus we hope that's what happens as we serve our students well. And when it's not going well relationally, to ask good questions. What can I change? What am I doing wrong? Am I hurting my students, et cetera, rather than let's have more fun things so that, you know, they're going to like me. Another motive, and I think we longer teachers tend to have this motive, is we really don't want hassles. So the moment you say as a teacher, I am sick and tired of, be careful. Now we say that sometimes after school, don't we, to other teachers. I'm just so sick and tired of. But you know what? If you're not careful, you will use your authority to try to crush that issue. I am so sick and tired of students with their sloppy work. This is ridiculous. And so now I'm going after them not to help them, not to serve them and grow them and to add some discipline that they really should have, but it's because I am annoyed. Or I'm just so frustrated with these papers coming in late. I'll tell you what, I'm just going to put a zero at the top of those papers. And we just got to punish them until they quit it. So again, I'm using my authority because I am frustrated. Well, we are frustrated sometimes. But somehow to hold before you every single day, every single question, the simple question, what is best for my students? What is best? Is it best to allow them to hand in their papers late? No, it isn't. Is it best to allow them to be sloppy? No, it isn't. But can you understand how you will handle the situation and your way of helping them even and how you talk about it looks so different if you say, you know, students, I'm getting in pretty much late work. Now, I hope your school has policies that you don't really have to do this. I'd encourage you to have it if you don't. Very direct policies how to handle things, so not every teacher does it differently. But if you're not in that situation, still, you think about now how you're going to handle it. So it's so different to go to your students and talk about this. And you know what? This is life. Being responsible, getting our work done. And so I'm going to have to put some policy in place. I'm going to have to put some consequences to help us be better disciplined and take a little more seriously getting our work in. However you're going to work through that. Whatever the consequences, whatever the parents, however you drag them in, is different than saying, you know what, last night I was correcting papers and I was missing three papers again. Now I need to chase you down, get these papers, correct them later, as if I have time for that, and, you know, get them in the grade book, I got all these holes. So I'm going to give some consequences if this keeps happening. Won't the students right away smell that this is really about you? So you can use your authority for no hassles or things that just irritate you. And then you come across accordingly. And your students sit back and sure they'll cooperate because they have to, but you've communicated to them that authority means control. And authority means I can make people do what I want if it bugs me and irritates me. And we don't want to raise a generation of children thinking that. That authority means power used in that way. Our goal should be, and we've had some discussions even here, and I do not know what to do with this other than I'm going to say this. Our goal should be that we position every student for success. That should be our servant heart for our students. I want every student to be able to be successful in my classroom. And we have a long, long way to go to get there. It's very difficult because we tend to have this line that we call A's and B's and C's. Do you realize that 100% means perfect? And we smile so approvingly on those students. Boy, do they ever scratch our back and float our boat, like we say. We love those students. They make us feel successful. They had 100. They knew everything I taught them. And we reward them and smile and put up 100% stickers or whatever you might do or read off who all got the 100%. We're punishing those who tried very hard and just didn't get there. They can't be a success. How often are we communicating to our students, the ones that make us really happy are the ones who get good grades? How can we have schools that every student has a chance, not at getting 100%, but at being a success in your school system? I believe that is what God does for us. God does not look down and say, here's the level of quality that you must perform in life. It's way up there. Then I'm really happy. The man who had 10 talents was expected to have 10. The one who had 5 was expected to have 5. God didn't say, you have 5, but you ought to match the 10. But we're doing that with our students. Sometimes we're doing that, I'm saying. How can we have enough of flex so that every student has a chance of being successful and under your blessing? Teachers, just remember how tender the hearts are of our students. Just imagine coming to school day after day and just knowing, I'm going to fail again. I'm going to fail again. And then we get after them because they have a bad attitude and they hate school. Would you enjoy going to school if every day you knew the board is frowning on your performance and you just can't quite get there and you're compared to the best teachers in the school? Would you just come in joyfully every day and try again? Strike out. I'll try again, you know. Come in. But we expect that out of our students. I think we do not think enough about how we can kill the morale in our students because of levels of expectations. Now, I know you say, oh, but then they're going to become lazy. All right, I realize there's lots of ditch here. But I am increasingly burdened for students who hate school, and then we ask this famous question, did you do your best? And they know what the answer better be, right? No. And then, well, why didn't you do your best? Doesn't God expect you to do your best? Yeah. And we manipulate them and we make them feel guilty. Do you do your best every day? No, you don't. I'll assure you that if your board chairman would say in any day of the week that he's going to come and visit you tomorrow, you would work just a little extra hard to prepare the classes, wouldn't you? Well, I sure would anyhow. So apparently I wasn't doing my best, huh? I mean, that's manipulating students to say, do your best, do your best. Unless we define it a little bit, which I like to think of a sustainable best. I don't know if they can make sense of that, but we can, right? A sustainable best is an honest effort every day to do well. But when we tug them and pull them to this best, best word, and they have to be honest, and they say, well, I'm sure I could have done better, and then, well, why didn't you do? Well, you got to do your best. And we put that guilt on them. We're just crushing those little hearts. They hate school. After a while, they do have attitudes. Sure. So think of each student as, am I putting them in a position where they can be under my blessing? this goes slightly outside of maybe our discussion, but I am going to give these two statements. Which do you think is most true of children, and especially children that come from hard places? Children do well if they want to, or children do well if they can? Depending which one you believe is more true than the other one is going to determine how you relate to struggling students. Am I making sense? Students do well if they want to. That's the problem. He got a bad attitude. He wants to come into school and mess up every day, do dumb stuff, frustrate his classmates, not work well, maybe do some really off-the-wall things. That's just what he wants to. He doesn't have to act like that. I watch him in church and sits with his daddy just fine. He comes to school and he wants to act like that. Really? Are you sure? You sure he wants to act like that? Or does he long to figure out how to fit in to society and into the home and into the class to not look like the person that's always getting in trouble? Children do well if they can. I really believe is at least more true. They want to, but we often don't know how to put them in a position where they can do well, because we don't understand their needs. And we still often don't understand their needs. But if that is our orientation toward them, we want to put them in a position where they can do well, rather than a level of expectation where they can't, and then we say it's because you don't want to. Let's move on to the next section. Teaching from a servant heart, create an atmosphere in which learning can take place. Teachers, I want to go back to this comment before that I made. You have authority. It is your job. Teachers, you can ruin the school year because you do not take the authority to structure your classroom for success. And some of that can be because we are too insecure, or we're too just not structured ourselves, or we want our students to like us, and we're sure that if we draw some lines, they're not going to like us. I am appalled once in a while what I see in classrooms. I say once in a while. I don't want to paint that everything's bad, and I'm sorry I'm a Christian Light rep, and I'm not saying this to intimidate anybody. If I was in your classroom, I have none of you in mind, I assure you. But I've been appalled already at the restlessness, the dirty floor, the scattered books, the whispering going on right while the teacher's up front teaching. I have no idea what those children are learning. It's obvious they are not listening to what is being said, because they can be whispering, they can be laughing, or they're teaching one grade, the other grade, they can be getting up, talking. Okay, they might need some help. You do what works for you. But to create this restless spirit becomes chaos. But you know, to come and say, all right, this has to stop, it's simply because we're not learning like we need to. So when I'm teaching, I'm actually asking that there's no talking. What if I need to get a drink? You'll be thirsty when the class is over yet, I assure you. You can kindly, that's the rule. We have to, and you know what? Their students will thank you for that. Over and over again, students are frustrated that the teacher doesn't create a quiet classroom. Through the years, I've done once in a while special middle and upper grades, just for fun, said, you know, we're discussing rules, and I like to talk about that with my students. So where are rules? Do we got some fuzzy lines? Yeah, this is a little fuzzy. I'm allowing some whispering, but it's getting a little too fuzzy. And, you know, work through some things. Okay, let's tighten it up. And so what would you do if you were the teacher? I've already had them write down some things. Give me some, like, if you'd be a teacher, what would be some of your rules? Outside of the few who like to just say off-the-wall things just because that's what they do, most of them say amazingly strict things. No whispering. Say good morning respectfully. I mean, it's amazing how, you know, yeah, that's their heart. They want to come to school and feel secure. They want day after day to be just about the same. Teachers, please remember that. They thrive on every day being just about the same. Oh, once in a while you do something different. But most days are very predictable. That's how they thrive. That's how God made them to be. And especially students who come from hard places, sometimes to start the day by saying, well, today is going to be a day like you've never seen before. But let's start with devotions. What? They're out of control. What's happening? And we can just ruin those students. And then they're not listening in devotions. Hey, they're not listening to me. You know, pay attention. You know? They don't know what's happening. Most students will respond with some insecurity, some with a lot of insecurity. And we're generating the problem by setting up that suspense. They can't handle it. There's children that just cannot handle it. If you have those students, learn that. It is your job. You are the teacher. You call the shots. Now you might say, wow, what a control freak. Well, you're to serve your students. The question ultimately is, what is best for these students? How can they best learn? What's the environment? Now, it can get too stuffy. I've been in classrooms that, wow, I mean, it was really tight and just austere, and it just felt so regulated that, see, maybe the students did have a hard time relaxing. I mean, you can go too far, of course. There's lots of, right? But come back to the question of, what will make my students feel secure? I was visiting my brother, this would be, so I can say it. This was many years ago. I, by then, had taught a little bit, and he was a little nervous that I'm there visiting him. Might have been his first year. So I'm sitting in the back of the room just enjoying this opportunity, and he's teaching all class, and another student that was in a different grade, so he didn't have to be listening, decided it was time to empty out his desk. Now, one thing was very true. He needed to clean out his desk. No question. But now was the time. And he begins to take the books out, as well as many other things, of course, that were in his desk. He found a wad of tape, I believe it was, a little sticky, and so dun 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 dun. And my brother is looking over there, looking back at me, and then trying to teach, and he more stuff out yet, and other students are watching. He's looking at me, looking at him, and trying to teach. Okay, a tough situation indeed. Have something like that going on in the room, and what do? You're the teacher. It has to stop. You don't have to be ugly. But he could have, the moment he saw what was happening, just said, hey, you know what? We do need to clean out your desk sometime, but not quite, not now, please, okay? Just, it's okay. I'll talk to you later about it. Thanks for, I mean, you do need to, but just keep working, please. It's a little distracting. Okay, back to class. He's a teacher. He can say, now's not the time to clean out your desk. Be careful that you don't overreact with your authority. A few years ago, I walked into grades 9 and 10 to teach Spanish. About 15, 20 students. I was not homeroom teacher. I walked in, happily got up front, laid my book open. Okay, students, ready for Spanish class. And out of absolutely nowhere, turned up 16 to 20 pillows. And everybody promptly. One of them was my son. Only to find out later they had discussed it on the school trip the night before, very late at night. If they think that, would your dad get mad? And my son said, I think it'll be okay. So I have no idea where those pillows all were. In the desk, in their backpacks, because I didn't see a one. And suddenly, it was just, whoosh, there they were. All their heads down, slightly grinning. I just stood there, I said, you are so bad. Okay, what do I do? What do I do? Well, kind of grunched around and there, you know, kind of looking. What am I going to do? Oh, okay. So I muttered a little something, went out, ran down the steps, ran into the furnace room, and hit the fire alarm. Those students up and looked around and burp! It's ringing full blast, of course. Some even grabbed their pillows and out the door. And so all these students must walk a line, first graders, and they're looking at the 10th graders with their pillows. It was the most memorable fire drill I ever pulled off. I'm sure I hadn't warned the first and second grade teachers, but now was the time for a fire drill. So we ran, of course, all the other teachers are looking. What? Pillows? I mean, 9 and 10. But I quickly said, it's okay, you know. So we called them all back in, and we got back in and said, all right, what a good joke. You know, it was all fine and fun. Let's put our pillows away, and all right, we're ready for class. They pulled it off. It was okay. It felt marginally, you know, but I would rather struggle with that. That sometimes they almost overstep or do, but I did not scold them in this case. They were 9th and 10th graders. They did not have a bad attitude as such. I would rather struggle with sometimes they're getting a little close to the edge. Then I walk in the room and they're quiet. Or they're whispering and I walk by and, you know, something's wrong, something's wrong. I would rather run those risks than tighten up so much that it can go the other way. Had I stood up front and said, you know, how dare you do that? That's just disrespectful. Put your pillows away. Okay. Stuff them back in. And then, all right, let's have class. I'm not here to, you know, to waste my time. Spanish class, come on. It just wouldn't have, it would have been a very awkward class, believe me. And it would have lacked a good story. Show acceptance and appreciation for each student. We all know, and let's just be honest, some students are more lovable than others. That is certainly the truth. Teachers, it's our job. I think of the beautiful story where Jesus took those children and took them in his arms, put his hand on them, and blessed them. Well, certainly Jesus did not pick and choose, did he? He didn't wink and signal to the ones that, wow, they look like bright, cute children. I would be so glad to bless them. We wouldn't imagine Christ doing that. But in our hearts, we can do that. Certain students that we just kind of light up when we see them. Hey, good morning. Good morning. And we kind of engage and talk with them. And then other students, good morning. You know, of course, we have to say good morning. We have to at least be nice. Students smell that so quickly. When you have a certain delight in some students, and yes, you're too proper to be, you know, better than to be ugly, but you just don't express the joy in the relationship with those other students. Those are often the students that need you the most. Those are sometimes the students that left the house without a blessing from their parent. You know, if we could know what all our students. And sometimes, obviously now, don't be a suspicious teacher, but truth is, there are some students who come from dysfunctional homes. They need you. They need at least one place to go where they're loved and accepted, where they're not compared to other students. Those often come with baggage that makes it hard to give them that love. And I want to be careful what I say here, because obviously situations are sensitive. But I've had the privilege of teaching some students recently where, you know, mom left the home. So those kind of situations. Well, can you imagine how disheveled the young man looked when he came to school? His clothes, his hair, you know, came in. Yeah, very difficult to show the same grace and love. But the one who needed it the most. Who needed sometimes to just sit down and just talk about it and see his tears. Big boy, it's okay. But for me to add insult and hurt to a hurting child already. Sometimes we see some things, maybe in church, and you see the relationship between the mom and the daughter, the son and the father. Oh, that makes some sense. That's why he comes to school with such a swagger. He's trying to figure out to be somebody. He looks like he's proud and arrogant. He's the most insecure child in your school because he's fighting to be somebody because nobody thinks he is at home. Dad always, you know, puts him down. He said, really? This is happening in our churches? Well, I don't know if it's happening in your school, but let's be honest. It happens in our churches and in our schools where students need you as a teacher to bless them. And often again, they're the very ones that are difficult to bless. There was a study done by, these were not Christian teachers, by a group of teachers, or professors, whoever they were, with a whole stack of essays written by students of a certain grade level, and they were predetermined. These papers were predetermined to be of equal quality. Equal quality writing, these essays. All they did is put a picture of the child with each essay. So they would grab a paper, see the child, read it, and give a grade. Grab it and give a grade. Grab it, give a grade. Multiple teachers. And you can imagine what they found. The cute children got better grades. The less attractive looking children got worse grades. Do you have students in your room that you can hardly bear to give them a low score because, well, you know why. They did another one where all they did is put the name of the student on the paper. And students with the more popular names got better grades than those with less popular, outdated names. You see the nuances of how we can look at people just as little things. We judge them. We judge them. We do it so quickly. We judge people by just how they handle themselves, how they look. Right away, it's that first impression. They walk into your classroom. That you might be new to the school. In fact, how many of you are going to new communities, new schools, first-year teachers? Only a few, but a few are. Well, those of us who've walked into those situations, I remember I had been teaching quite a few years, but I went back to the school I'd started in and went back to that school, but I didn't know any of the students. And so as they walked in that morning, and I looked at some pictures and, are you David? No, I'm Rodney. Okay, Rodney, got it. You know, but those first impressions, just how they walked in, how they looked, how their hair was combed, the clothes they wore, make impressions just like that. And then we can kind of have that. How unfair. Again, I've made this mistake so many times. Those students that need you the most are sometimes the hardest to love. But pray for grace. Sit in their seats and pray for them. I'd encourage you to do that. I know what that's like, to need to do that. Go in early. Sit in that student's desk and cry out to God for love and understanding and compassion for this child. And God will answer your prayer. Be consistent in expectations and discipline. This is extremely difficult because we tend to think of sameness and fairness as the same word. And it really isn't. And I don't always know what to do with that. But sameness is doing the same thing for the same person every time. I am a consistent teacher. You do this, that happens. You do this, that happens. I don't care who you are. I'm a consistent teacher. We have policies. I know of schools who have policies for how to discipline for offenses, and I am not saying we shouldn't, but I am concerned about the lack of flex that gives because children are not all the same in their ability to understand and even connect behavior to their consequences. But we got the model, the biblical model that would be, and this is what we do. This offense, this consequence. Sameness, is that fairness though? Is that really fair to the child? I could be misunderstood so quickly here. I don't have a whole lot more to say about it than that. That I just wanted to bring into question. That sameness is fairness. And again, as we understand the needs of those children who come from a dysfunctional home or come from a very hard place, they cannot connect the same dots as we consider the normal way of connecting dots. But the expectations are the same. The consequences are the same. And then we wonder why it's not working. And then you're told, well, if you keep doing the same thing often enough, it'll finally get through. No, not necessarily. When we get to the end of the year, we didn't really disciple. And I want to say this carefully. But I think some children, what normally works as discipline in the heart of one child, that child needs discipleship. Okay? Discipline and discipleship. I'm not trying to create two spheres per se. Children that need discipline also need discipleship. The answer is never just discipline. But sometimes students need more discipleship and less discipline, because that's how they can process and connect with you and build trust and connectedness. A great book out there, The Connected Child. You first connect and then you correct. And some children you can connect quickly and you can correct and you can move on. Others, the focus is trying to connect, and then maybe you can correct. But that needs to be the context. We must connect, then correct. So while we're being consistent with the needs. We're consistently trying to meet the needs. We're not trying to do it the same for every student. Now, the other side, of course, is consistency in our approach in that. We must be careful we don't come one day to school and we're just feeling grouchy and our students know. Somebody said that their students knew the mood their teacher was in by how he combed his hair. So just make sure you comb your hair the same every day. So, you know. We can come across some days with things in our life that aren't always going so well, and disappointments, a tough weekend, relationships that are tough, and then we kind of bring that into school. We must learn to compartmentalize that every day we bring our best foot forward. A saying that I really like, and I forgot to write it down, but it goes something like this. The best thing about teaching school is that it matters. The hardest thing is that it matters every day. It matters every day. If you're in construction, you can probably wake up not feeling so well, and you can go out and still do a good job in framing that house. You're not really talking a lot that day. But you can't go to school that way. You can't go to school that way. You must go with your best foot forward. Within reason, let me say. Our emotions do ebb and flow, but we cannot give in to highs and lows of our emotion, and our students just suffer as we move along. All right? Consistent students know how you're going to handle things, again, within reason. Never shame a student. Never shame a student. When I think of that, I always think of the same story. And some of you might have heard this again, but I'm going to say it. This was in, thankfully, 1989, but it still is fresh in my memory. Little girl in the front was crying. And I said, Sharon, why are you crying? I mean, 17 fifth graders. Sharon, just tell me. Why are you crying? Everybody's watching now. All the students know she's crying. And I ask her a couple times, she said, come up here and just tell me. She kind of got up and she sat down. And she finally got up after a number of tries and she whispered in my ear. She said, you mocked Kevin. Sat down. I mocked Kevin. Wow. Yeah, I did mock Kevin. I did. And a little girl, it broke her heart, fifth grade. because she smelled that shame I put on a student. And she couldn't handle it and cried. Some of you know what Pathways vocabulary books look like. How many know what I'm talking about? Pathway? All right. And I haven't seen them in many years, but I can still see it in my mind's eye. Fifth grade, I think, is orange, at least used to be. All those 20 words in part A. Part B, it's bottom of the page, finishes on the top, right? Yes, and then more exercises. Well, Kevin was rather lazy. And he, number one maybe matches with number one. Number two maybe matches with number two, and just wrote in those answers. And rather than go to him as a servant, loving teacher and saying, you know, Kevin, this, you know this isn't right. This doesn't even make sense, does it? I instead read the answers from up front. You should be appalled at me. You should be. It was wrong. But I stood up front and I read a couple answers. I said, does that make sense? I shamed him in front of everybody. I had to apologize. I'm sorry. That was wrong of me. I'm sorry, Kevin. Will you forgive me? In front of everybody. If you shame your students, please tell them you're sorry in front of them. If you need to cry, just cry a little bit. To just ignore that and say, well, he wrote a bunch of stupid answers, so, you know, I'm trying to help him quit it. Would have ruined everything, wouldn't have it? You know, in one moment of anger or shame, you can undo a lot with your students. But if you have the grace to apologize, you can at least start to redeem it. And maybe even completely redeem it. Never shame your students. Now, it would be vastly different if somebody's acting up in the class and just say, hey, I can't teach when you're doing that. You need to stop. I'll talk to you later about it. It's embarrassing, but it's not shaming. Understand the difference? We have a hard time doing that because, you know, it's embarrassing to us even. But it's one thing to call a student down, and everybody knows that, guess what? Teacher saw that and he didn't let it go, and they're glad you didn't, right? They get frustrated if you do because they're trying to have class and listen too, at least quite a few of them. But to shame them is to make them look stupid, and you're pushing them down. I don't know if he remembers that story today. I believe he's a preacher today. Please do remember, your students grow up. I have a few teachers that are here that I taught their daddies. Now their boys are here. Walking around. Remember, they'll grow up and they'll remember those times, how you made them feel. And it's not that you should be motivated that I don't want to someday pay the consequences of doing it. It's because what is right now. But there are the consequences that you could pay later as well. Last of all, live a worthy example. Teachers, you are under authority. If you're going to serve your students well and lovingly and expect them to be under your authority because you're using your authority to bless them and have a good classroom, meet their needs, you better be under authority as well. And teachers who talk against the curriculum or against church standards, and I've seen all of this happen up front, just can't do that. We just can't do that. If we talk disrespectfully to our authority or the government or, of all things, and I hate to even say this, but I'm going to, COVID issues, because you're going to face it this year. If you say, oh, that is so disgusting, I can't believe it, back to wearing masks again. Well, I'm not wearing mine. That's just ridiculous. Or, come on, I can't believe it. That they don't work. This is just pointless. These politicians, it's all about, you know. What are they going to do the next time you make a rule that they think is pointless and stupid and ridiculous? You're going to have the same attitude. Oh, you need to respect me. I'm the teacher. Listen, it's the same at all levels of authority. Those under authority need to show the same respect that you expect on the next level down. Now, can you say that you are quite sure that that's the best thing? Well, of course you don't have to be intellectually dishonest. You might say, wow, and that's pretty tough. I don't know. What, my dad says the masks don't work. You know what? I'm not a doctor. I don't know. Could be. They really don't. But guess what? Let's just be respectful. And whatever your family decides to do is up to them. For me, if I'm required to wear a mask to go to Walmart, I'm going to wear a mask. I'll say I've been deeply disappointed across the Mennonite churches of our attitude toward authority. We're going to pay for it with our young people. We're going to pay for it for our children. If they hear us as leaders at church level, school level, parents make snide remarks about our government because it doesn't make sense. What are we telling them they should think and do when you tell them to do something that doesn't make sense? So you're saying we have the prerogative to decide what makes sense and doesn't make sense, and then we obey accordingly. Now, we can, in some level, evaluate what seems to make sense and not sense, but our attitude and our cooperation are not negotiable. And when we teach them that it is, expect that then to happen in your classroom. Why wouldn't it? You're the example. You're the one that they're calling. You're calling them to follow you. You're the one that the parents are trying to hold up and teach respect, and your teacher's a great person. How you handle things in sportsmanship, be an example. You know, I love playing volleyball. I love winning. I really do. But we must win. We must lose graciously and win graciously as well. When the students see the teacher's getting a little worked up and he's kind of hogging the ball sometimes and he's kind of, you know, or you're teaching them that, you know what, winning matters more than relationships. And how incredibly selfish. Somebody's got to lose 50% of the people. So why aren't you one of the 50% sometimes? And take it graciously and show them that it's just fine. What a great game. That was a good fight, but we lost. They're watching you. They really are. And the next time you win and they don't respond very well, and you want to talk to them about it. But they read your expression on your face too. Outside of school, teachers, especially, and I hate to say this, but especially young people, because it's not fair to pick on young people, but I think it is especially true of young people. Stories get back to school about what young people do on the weekends. And that's been disappointing sometimes in schools. They heard that he was driving pretty fast. Or they heard that he was involved in that activity and, ooh, I didn't think that's acceptable. And your students find out. It's like, wait a minute. Who you are up front as a teacher, and then how you dressed, the music you listened to, how you drove your car. Or maybe you are known, I'm going to be a little too honest here, I know, maybe you're known to be a snobby young person and a cliquish young person. But then at school, oh, we're supposed to all love each other and just accept each other. And they say, huh. My brother and sister say, you don't even talk to them at church. You're a snob. You think you're some, you know. Listen, this happens in our schools. It does. And you hear it from the students. And it's confusing because the teacher's trying to make them be these loving, kind people. And they know full well that that's not how you live when you get out of school. You're not known to be that kind of a person. Teachers, I beg you, be known to be a gracious, kind person in your community. Or you will undo what you're trying to teach them. Well, God bless you as you go into this school year. Remember, children have tender hearts. Remember, you are being trusted by the authorities at school and the board and the parents. Live humbly. Pray much for your students. Pray for grace. Thank you. You're excused.
This recording and many others are available through Christian Learning Resource, the campus bookstore at Faith Builders. Order online at www.christianlearning.org or call 877-222-4769.